Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Michael Link, former UN Human Rights Special Rapporteur in the occupied Palestinian territories, who assesses the likely impact of the World Court's ruling, finding that Israel's occupation of Palestinian land is illegal. Aaron Regenberg of the group Pass the Torch, who discusses the campaign that succeeded in pressuring President Biden to drop his re-election bid and Vice President Kamala Harris's rise as the Democrats' de facto presidential nominee. And Joel Nieves, an occupant of a shelter built for the unhoused at the Amistad Catholic Worker House in New Haven, Connecticut, who talks about the battle against city government, which is attempting to evict the shelter's residents. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Only days after winning the United Kingdom's July 4th election, ending 14 years of conservative government, the victorious Labour Party announced the early release of thousands of prisoners to avert an overcrowding crisis. Incoming Prime Minister Keir Starmer, a former chief prosecutor, declared, "The nature of the problem is pretty unforgivable." The Labour government will start releasing prisoners convicted of minor offenses who have served 40% of their sentence starting in September. It's estimated that 8,000 to 10,000 prisoners will be released. The prison population in England and Wales has doubled over the last 30 years, while the rate of crime has fallen. The Guardian reports that Labour's newly appointed prison commissioner, James Timpson, has praised the Dutch prison system, which uses community sentences to ease overcrowding, keeping offenders closer to their homes and jobs, and has resulted in closing half the Netherlands' prisons. A wave of youth-driven protests in Kenya has upended a regressive government tax increase plan mandated by International Monetary Fund austerity measures. Kenya's President William Ruto withdrew the tax hike after protesters stormed into parliament, whereupon he fired his cabinet and initiated talks with the protesters. During the late June protests, Kenyan security forces killed 50 people and arrested over 600 activists. Protesters are angry over high rates of unemployment, corruption, wage stagnation, and the rising cost of living. Currently, one-third of government revenue goes to paying debt service. The Economist reported John Githongo, a former government anti-corruption czar, said, "The finance bill wasn't the root cause of the protests. The biggest grievance is the conspicuous consumption of the Ruto regime." Ruto was elected in 2022 on an anti-poverty platform, but imposed unpopular pro-market policies such as eliminating food and fuel subsidies, a move favored by the IMF, which has imposed similar measures in Egypt, Pakistan, and Nigeria. Predictions over election winners and losers in the swing state of Arizona changed immediately after Arizona's Supreme Court upheld its 1864 territory-era law, which outlawed abortion, except when a mother's life was at risk, and enabled courts to sentence abortion providers to prison. A majority of Arizonans were outraged, and the state Republican Party split between MAGA extremists and moderates. Only three Republicans joined Democrats in the state legislature to overturn the state Supreme Court's ruling. Arizonans will likely have a chance to vote on a referendum protecting abortion rights under the state's constitution in November, which is favored to pass. Arizona pollster Paul Bentz predicted that voter turnout this November would likely approach record levels, giving Democrats a chance of winning the state's Electoral College votes and victory in two closely contested congressional races. Democrats are now outraising Republicans in campaign funds by a 3-to-1 margin. Meanwhile, independent pro-Democratic outreach groups have been pushing turnout. Unite Here, the Hospitality Workers Union, has sent 500 organizers to Arizona with the goal of registering new voters and knocking on 1 million doors before Election Day. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The International Court of Justice announced a landmark ruling on July 19th, which found that Israel's 57-year occupation of Palestinian territories is a violation of international law. The non-binding advisory opinion, issued by the court's 15-judge panel, stated Israel should stop settlement activity in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem and end its illegal occupation of those areas and the Gaza Strip as rapidly as possible. The ICJ, based at The Hague in the Netherlands, examined the issue after the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution in December 2022 requesting the court to give an advisory opinion on the legality of Israel's occupation of Palestinian land. Since 1967, Israel has built 160 settlements, housing some 700,000 Jews in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Israel's right-wing prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, rejected the court's ruling, maintaining that the Jewish people are not occupiers in their own land. Netanyahu, who's scheduled to address a joint session of the U.S. Congress on July 24th, will face tens of thousands of protesters who accuse his government of committing genocide in Israel's 9-month war in Gaza that's killed an estimated 39,000 Palestinians. Your reporter spoke with Michael Link, associate professor of law at the University of Western Ontario, Canada, and former UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories from 2016 to 2022. Here he assesses the likely impact of the International Court of Justice ruling.
This ruling has taken us to another level. It's been long established by a prior ruling 20 years ago by the International Court of Justice, by UN resolutions from the Security Council and the General Assembly, and by virtually a wall-to-wall opinion by countries around the world, that there were many features of the 57-year-old Israeli occupation that were illegal. The annexation, the formal annexation of East Jerusalem was deemed to be illegal. The Israeli settlements have been deemed to be illegal. The construction of a wall 700 kilometers going through the occupied West Bank has been deemed to be illegal. And the many violations of Palestinian human rights have been found to be a violation of international human rights law. But what hadn't been established until Friday with this ruling was whether the occupation itself had become illegal. And that's exactly what the court wound up stating in its advisory opinion to the General Assembly, that because Israel had annexed land contrary to very well-established international law with regards to the responsibilities of occupying powers, because Israel had been practicing discrimination and particularly apartheid, and because Israel had been denying Palestinian self-determination, these were the basis for the court finding that the occupation had now crossed the bright red line into illegality. And it said that the occupation had to end completely, i.e. going back to the 1967 June borders, and that Israel had to end the occupation, in the words of the court, as rapidly as possible. The court said it would leave the modalities of how to pressure Israel to obey this direction to the General Assembly and the Security Council. But we have a decision with astounding clarity as to what the law is regarding this occupation.
Professor Link, given that Israel doesn't recognize the jurisdiction of the court here and are likely to ignore this ruling, what's the possible impact this ruling may have on Israel's occupation in the future? Another question here is, what is the responsibility and obligation of Israeli allies such as the United States and Western European nations here, given the very sweeping nature of this court ruling?
Both good questions. With respect to the impact of the ruling, this will be up to the General Assembly to make decisions. We know that there's unlikely to be any movement coming from the Security Council because of the United States veto. And indeed, the State Department said over the weekend that it was disappointed in the ruling. It stated that the breadth of the court's opinion will complicate efforts to resolve the conflict and said it's going to strongly discourage parties from using the court's opinion as a pretext for further unilateral actions that deepen divisions or for supplanting a negotiated two-state solution. I found it as astonishing coming from the United States, particularly under a Democratic administration, when it was the United States actually that created and was instrumental through the 1940s to the 1960s in establishing much of the basis for our international legal system that we know today, and particularly for our international human rights legal system that has only grown in the time since the 1960s. But the impact among others, and particularly in Europe, is what I'm going to be watching for. There are many countries, I think, that have begun to shift their position towards Israel in the wake of the 9.5-month war on Gaza and the now more than 39,000 Palestinians who've been killed during the conflict. With respect to the global north, we can't count on the United States to do anything probably but to act as a diplomatic shield for Israel in a wide range of areas, including the Security Council, the General Assembly, and also to protect it with respect to the impact of this ruling. But in Europe, we now have a new government in the United Kingdom. We have the makings of a new government in France. Both of them promised to have a more probably critical view towards Israel and its forever occupation. And there are a range of countries already, including Ireland, Belgium, Spain, who have taken strong positions with respect to Israel. And in fact, several of them are joining with South Africa in the future litigation around the Genocide Convention. So what will happen, we'll have to wait and see with respect to the General Assembly. But it must be dawning on a wide number of countries, particularly in the global south, but also in the global north as well, that Israel is a serial defier of UN resolutions and of decisions coming from the International Court of Justice and likely coming from the International Criminal Court as well. And that until and unless significant economic, political, and diplomatic costs are imposed upon Israel for its defiance of international law and all of these resolutions, and for preventing the exercise of Palestinian self-determination, and for ending its now illegal occupation, nothing will change there. Accountability has to be the key word for the international community going forward. We have to have a situation where international law combined with international political resolve is the direction to try to bring peace and justice to both Israelis and Palestinians.
That was Michael Link, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Western Ontario and former UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories from 2016 to 2022. Learn more about the International Court of Justice ruling on Israeli occupation of Palestinian land by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The last several weeks have been witness to a series of stunning and consequential political events. The attempted assassination of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump was quickly followed by the GOP convention, where Trump announced his vice presidential running mate, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. Just 3 days later, President Joe Biden announced his decision to drop his re-election bid, endorsing his vice president, Kamala Harris, to be the Democratic Party nominee. After Joe Biden's disastrous June 27th debate with Donald Trump, a group calling itself Pass the Torch was formed to pressure the president to step aside and make way for a stronger candidate to take on Trump and his threat to democracy. The group recruited volunteers to make tens of thousands of phone calls to elected officials and organize protests across the country and at the White House. After Biden announced his departure from the campaign, the group praised the president for listening to voters and encouraged the Democratic Party to unite around Vice President Harris as their nominee. Your reporter spoke with Aaron Regenberg, a member of the Pass the Torch Steering Committee, who served two terms in Rhode Island's General Assembly. Here he talks about the rise of Kamala Harris as the Democratic Party's de facto candidate and the changed dynamics of the campaign to defeat Donald Trump and the Republican Party's extremist agenda.
There's certainly been a pretty crazy moment in American politics. And Pass the Torch has been a group of grassroots group of Democratic voters, organizers, activists, a few current and former electeds that came together just in the, you know, the days after that debate with the desire to try to do something about it. You know, our sense was be really important that the voices of regular Democratic voters be heard in this process. And so we wanted to, again, just a bunch of volunteers coming together, wanted to do what we could to help regular people be heard. So we, you know, put together a call tool and an email tool. We helped over 10,000 phone calls to Democratic reps and senators, another almost 20,000 online actions. We worked with volunteers on the ground in swing states to have some actions in Ohio and Michigan. We worked to support Democratic leaders that were coming out, had the courage to speak out on this and wanted to make sure they had backup. We had a rally at the White House this weekend doing all sorts of things. But again, the point was just most Democrats in this moment agreed and felt strongly that it was time for President Biden to pass the torch. And we felt it was important that those folks have some sort of group that's working to represent them and give them ways to make their voices heard. Most Democrats have cared about this so deeply because we understand that this election is existential in nature, right? Our party's been saying that for years, but it's not just a talking point. It's a reality, right? We're dealing with a movement that hasn't just dabbled in violent authoritarianism. Violent authoritarianism is the core of its identity, right? It's not just rhetoric to say democracy is on the ballot and abortion access is on the ballot and a livable future is on the ballot. It really is. And when the stakes are that high, we need to have a ticket that is in its best possible position to win.
Aaron, given the strength of Kamala Harris to become the Democratic Party nominee, what in your view are her strengths and weaknesses? And of course, people remember the trauma of believing that Hillary Clinton would be the first woman elected president in 2016. She wasn't. There's concern that racism and misogyny could play a huge role in determining who wins the election in November. A lot of fear out there of those prejudices, which certainly exist. Again, what's your assessment of Kamala Harris's strengths and weaknesses here?
Well, I think the biggest strength of any is that she is a strong communicator who can actually get out there and campaign vigorously every day and do, you know, the 10 interviews a day that we need and deliver our message. I think it's been very clear for a while that we don't have a Democratic problem in this election, right? Democrats have been doing fine, right? Democrats are winning special elections. Our swing state senators are up in the polls, right? That double digits above where Biden has been. Americans don't like Donald Trump, and they don't like his horrifying Project 2025 agenda. And I think they're ready to get behind a strong Democratic message. Yes, there's a lot of racism. There's a lot of misogyny in the United States. You'd have to be blind to argue otherwise. Having said that, I mean, Barack Obama won two times with over 50% of the vote, right? I don't actually think that the biggest problems with Hillary Clinton's campaign came from the fact that she was a woman, right? That there were other things going on as well. And as a group, which again, it's just a bunch of volunteers who came together in the last few weeks, I think we're figuring out what we want to do. And I think right now the focus is just overwhelmingly on supporting the new Democratic ticket to defeat fascism in November. That I think has to be all of our priority right now. On November 6th, I think there is a really important conversation we need to have as a party, because we were literally almost drawn over a cliff in the last couple weeks. Millions of Americans were feeling fear, And as a party, I think it would be healthy for us to have a real conversation about how did we get here, what allowed this to happen, and what can we do to clear out that rot and make sure that we're never in a position where we are heading full speed off a cliff again. But that's a conversation for November 6th, because right now we're up against fascism and we can win this race. We're now in a position where we've got a strong fighting chance and we're coming together and we're going to do everything we can to make sure that our democracy and our freedoms and our rights are there and safe on November 6th.
That was Aaron Regenberg, a member of the Pass the Torch Steering Committee, who served two terms in Rhode Island's General Assembly. Learn more about Pass the Torch and find analysis and commentary on the changed election campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the midst of a long-standing crisis in the availability of affordable housing in New Haven, Connecticut, the Amistad Catholic Worker community welcomed unhoused persons to set up tents in their backyard, offering their own kitchen and bathroom to provide basic amenities. Late last year, after raising funds, they installed 6 permanent tiny houses to provide homes for 8 individuals. A community then sprang up called Rosette Neighborhood Village, in which the formerly unhoused were equal participants with neighbors and other supporters. As winter approached, and after confrontations with the administration of New Haven's Democratic Party mayor, Justin Elliker, city and state officials allowed electricity to be turned on for 180 days to provide the shelters with heat in the cold weather and air conditioning in the summer. But because the shelters didn't meet state housing code, the mayor ordered residents to be evicted and electricity to be cut off in mid-July after the 180 days expired. A lawyer representing the Amistad community is now appealing the decision to cut off power. The day before the electricity was shut off, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Joel Nieves, one of the occupants of the Amistad House shelters. Nieves uses a CPAP machine to breathe when he sleeps, which requires electricity. Here he explains why he considers the backyard shelter his home and worries about his future.
I'm going to be honest. This is the first time since being anywhere, even in the drug program, where I feel like I'm at home. This is more, to me, like a home. We're a community. We help each other out. We do work here every day, every morning. We feed the whole community. It's not just us. It's people, random people anywhere are invited to come and break bread with us, which gives me a sense of pride because now I'm performing something. I'm helping out. I'm wiping a table down, you know, or whatever. But it gives me pride to be a part of something. And you feel like home. We have meetings. We sit down sometimes, you know, in the evening once the day is down. We have our little giggles moments. And it's great. What I want to tell the mayor and anyone else who's listening, you know, this is what I want to say. Am I not human? Do I not deserve to have someplace safe? Do I not deserve to feel like I belong somewhere, a sense of community? Am I not human like anybody else? I'm not asking for a free handout. I understand, you know, this is America. You strap your bootstraps and do what you need. But one thing Americans have always done was help. Where's our help? You know, we're not evil people. We're not bad people. We're just trying to live.
Before you got into addiction, did you have a job or a...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Okay, I had a fabulous career. My life was great. I did personal security work for most of my life. I got to travel the world. I guarded actors, musicians, diplomats. Yeah, it was a great, great life. Made a little money on it. Unfortunately, I got shot in the line of duty. So I have a few spinal surgeries. I had a bowel reconstruction. I've had a abdominal mesh across my stomach because I just keep getting hernias. I have fusions on my disc now also.
Is that what led to the addiction? Was it pain meds and from there?
I developed PTSD. And anyone who has any knowledge of PTSD, some of us have developed nightmares. It's horrific nightmares where you don't want to sleep. So I started a cocaine addiction, not to go to sleep. I'm not a doctor, but I figured out something that worked. And that's when my cocaine addiction started. It was for me trying to stay up for 4 or 5 days until I crashed. My PTSD hit, and then the addiction on top of that, I was uncontrollable. So I ask anybody, any citizen, any politician from the state, from the city of New Haven, we break bread every morning at 9 a.m. Come down and see what we do here. See that this is an honest place. If you come by and see how I live in this shed and what they're calling a shed, I don't consider it bad. I have everything I need. I have a shower. I have a place to cook my meals. I have a place to store food. I don't think most campgrounds have what we have. And I think this is a much safer environment than those campgrounds because of the elements. We're here, we're safe. We're able to lock doors with a key, you know, so any critters, any animals, we're okay. We have light, electricity. I'm able to stay communicated with the world on my phone. I can do everything as a normal person. And I invite anyone to come down and say if I'm suffering. I don't think I'm suffering, Mr. Mayor.
So the mayor has said that people here are suffering?
Well, the mayor said that he wants to make sure that this is a safe environment where the structures are not somewhere where we're safe inside. I don't know, Mr. Mayor. I feel more safe in there than I do hanging out at the train station.
That was Joel Nieves, a resident of shelters built for unhoused people at New Haven, Connecticut's Amistad Catholic Worker House. Learn more about the struggle to keep these shelters open and the criminalization of homelessness by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPPM in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.